thank you all for coming on a bank holiday Monday, and I think the turnout obviously justifies the title Bored with Your Feudism. So obviously we have, I know the Rabbi Lent was too reticent, I think, to introduce his father-in-law. But he's asked me to do it, and it is with pleasure that I introduce you to Dr. Tali Lowenthal, who's a lecturer in Jewish spirituality at the Department of Hebrew and Jewish Studies at University College London. He was born in Haifa and educated in London, and then studied at UCCL, where he gained a PhD on the history of Hasidim in 1981, and he's the author of Communicating the Infinite, The Emergence of Chabad School, the University of Chicago Press in Chicago 1990, and many articles, both academic and popular. He lectures on topics such as Orthodox responses to the Holocaust and Hasidim and modernity. For several years, he's been working on a broad research project on the theme of Orthodoxy and modernity, funded by the Memorial Foundation of Jewish Culture and Institute for Jewish Studies. He's working on a book on Hasidim and modernity and postmodernity. And so it is obvious that he is well-versed and well-able to speak to us at our level of education and knowledge. And it is a pleasure that I introduce you.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, of course, no one is bored with Judaism in any way. Judaism is the most fantastic, exciting experience, and every day, both men and women, we have in the prayer book in front of us, blessed be us, O God, who did not make me a non-Jew, he made me a Jew. And it's a phenomenal thing that we have this tremendous, tremendous inheritance of Jewish teaching over the years. Sometimes in outreach work, when speaking to people who are at that point not really that aware of their Jewish heritage, there is an image, a way of trying to explain what it is to have this heritage of Judaism, that one tells someone, what would happen if suddenly you got a letter from a solicitor? You open it up, and you've never heard of this chap, you know, Brown and Smith or something, you know, Chancery Lane, London, you know, what is this? He says, you've got a great-great-great uncle seven times removed, and he's just passed away in South America, and he's left you £7 million, which is quite a lot of euro as well. So, probably better. So, you will then want to find some way of making access to this tremendous wealth. And in fact, each of us has this tremendous, tremendous heritage, going back thousands of years with a tremendous wealth of literature, of ideas, teachings, which have literally had a tremendous effect on the world. There's an old joke that a very large proportion of the world follow one Jew or other. They might follow Jesus, or they might follow Karl Marx, or they might follow someone who himself was, like Muhammad, very inspired by the Jews and thought that he was, at the beginning, he thought he was creating a variety of Judaism. So Judaism has had this tremendous, tremendous effect. And we're here at the end of the chain. And there's, you know, so how on earth could one possibly talk about being bored? That's, what a shocking idea. And how could one imagine that everyone is not totally dedicated and enjoying and experiencing and doing all these wonderful Jewish things and all conversant with the Talmud, like this lovely volume of it here. Everyone, we would have thought that everyone would be just swimming in it, you know, like Olympic swimmers, you know, backwards and forwards 100 lengths every morning. Well, that's another facet of the interesting paradox of history. See, I lecture and I write about the process of modernity. So modernity is a very fascinating thing. What do we mean by modernity? Didn't people 900 years ago think we are modern and the people of 100 years ago were old-fashioned? Funnily enough, they didn't. They didn't think in that way. We have begun thinking. It's a process which has taken several hundred years, and I have a wonderful professor in the university that very often we would sit down to a lecture and he would start saying, when did the process of modernity begin? Was it the French Revolution or the Enlightenment? And one of the ways of understanding what the process of modernity is was described by a very famous sociologist, non-Jewish sociologist called Max Weber. And he said that modernity, I'm going to use this wonderful whiteboard, which has been specially erected for the purpose. Modernity is, you always have to check that it's a whiteboard marker, because if it's an indelible marker, you've spoilt it forever. So he said modernity is the process whereby, he actually said it in German, but brothers become others. The Bruder becomes Order. The one who is supposed to be a brother. In other words, my grandfather did business with a certain gentleman, and I am doing business with that gentleman's grandson. That's how it's been for centuries. The problem is that in the process of modernity, I find that I can make a bigger profit if instead of going to this grandson of my father, my grandfather's business associate, there's someone in Hong Kong who can supply it much cheaper. So I go there, or I go somewhere else. And so this relationship that has been going for generations is suddenly broken. The brother becomes an other, and all I'm interested in is my own profit motive, my own advantage. Suddenly a sense of selfishness. Now that means that we basically put a line through a concept called tradition. Right? Unfortunately, tradition is suddenly rubbed off the board, because there was a sense of stability and of harmony and of wholesomeness. This place over here at the front. It's Don't worry. We've only just begun. There is a sense of stability and of wholesomeness in this concept of tradition, and what happens is modernity takes that away. That suddenly the word tradition becomes a dirty word. Instead, we have a very beautiful word. It's a very exciting word. It's a lovely word. In fact, I'm not even going to do it in black. I'm going to take a different color. It is the word new. New is the most powerful, beautiful word, which means that it's new, there's something special, our parents didn't have it, our grandparents didn't have it. In fact, not only that, we're now in 2007, they didn't have it in 2005. That's new, that's the process of modernity, this process of constant change. There's a charming sociologist at London University, who my wife knows. They're both in the same university, or she's now retired, as my wife is trying to do, and in Royal Holloway, London University. And so this lady, Bernice Martin, she writes a definition of modernity, the acceptance of constant change as a way of life. Right? That idea, constant change, always. It's got to be something new, it's got to be something different, got to be something exciting. Now, if that's the environment, yeah, we'll write that up, constant change. If that's the atmosphere, constant change is the theme in life, and, you know, if you had Windows XP a couple of years ago, you really thought you were at the top of the pile, and suddenly, nowhere, there's Windows 2005, there's a complete different world out there, and you're backwards. So in that kind of atmosphere, people come to shul, people attend Jewish situations, whether in the home or in the synagogue, some kind of communal atmosphere, family, my cousin this, my mother, it all seems like a little, you know, this beautiful, quaint little world, but there's a real exciting world out there, and that's the exciting world which is pulling me, and that's what's drawing me. And so therefore, it could be that a person looks at Jewish life, Jewish teaching, it just seems static. You know, it's the same today as it was 10 years ago. It hasn't, you know, what was 10 years ago in computers? Windows 95. You know, like it's old fashioned, it's gone. Whoever would use such a thing nowadays? And we're not talking about 10 years old, we're talking about hundreds of years old, thousands of years old. And so that's the kind of problem that people feel. And let's try, God forbid we should call Judaism boring in any way, but do you understand that we are exposed to different kinds of current? And when we are in this current of the new, of the exciting, the constant challenge, and the reduction in sensitivity of commitment to each other. You know, if everyone is very deeply committed to each other as a person, you can survive the new. You can get on very well because we're brothers together, blood brothers, and we're going to go through this, we're going to fight through this. Whatever it is that happens, it's not going to tear us apart. But unfortunately, it doesn't always work like that. And so we face attrition, a war of attrition against Jewish life and Jewish culture. And here, in this wonderful city of Dublin, my wife and I had the great pleasure today with our family here to visit the museum, helped by Mr. Raphael Seif. A most beautiful experience, seeing what exactly Dublin is and what Dublin represents. Really, Dublin Jewry is like an outpost. It's something with a tremendous, tremendous history and responsibility. A pass back into the past, which therefore is an empowerment for the future. And so it's therefore with that idea in mind that we're looking at briefly tonight to the idea of, in some way, adding zest, adding the new and the exciting and the challenge into our lives, our personal lives as Jewish people and our Judaism. Now, so therefore, one of the things I do with my students in university is I present them with this type of picture. I say, you know, we've got the new and we've got the tradition. There's a bit more dates, you know. So there's the new and there's the traditional. Can we find the new in the traditional? And we start looking at Jewish texts and Jewish teachings. Now, there was a book written. I brought along something to not only be able to write things on the board, but even to rub them off as well. Look at that. And that proves that I didn't use the indelible marker by mistake. Now, there was a book written in 1796. It's interesting, you know, when you look at books written in Eastern Europe, places like that, you don't know what kind of teaching, what kind of ideas might it be saying. And we find a very, very interesting concept there. We find the concept of challenge as being a very important part of a person's service of God. Challenge. And it presents the following picture. So it's like this. It's a Hasidic work. And it says like this. There are people who serve God. Let's enter into the mindset. Serving God. And not serving God. Sorry about the squeaking. There is also the concept of righteous and non-righteous. And all of these are together in the same verse in Tanakh. You will turn back and see the difference between the righteous and the non-righteous, the one who serves God, the one who doesn't serve God. He said, what does it mean? You got the righteous and the non-righteous. Why does it then talk about serving God and not serving God? And he presents a very interesting analysis, which I think is very relevant for us. He says, righteous and non-righteous, you know, that's talking about what the behavior of the person is. So if the person is righteous, basically he's doing the right thing. If he's not righteous, okay, so he's not yet doing the right thing. But even if he's doing the right thing, he could be in condition A or condition B. He could be serving God or not serving God. What? It's a very strange idea. You can be doing the right thing and not serving God. Are you hearing straight? Have I got muddled up? It's always possible. He says like this. You might be doing the right thing. You might be keeping all the mitzvahs. But there's no challenge for you. It's not exciting. It's just what you do. That's how you're programmed. It's comfortable. Each little bit of the day or the week or whatever it is, you do the right thing. The morning you get up, you go to the synagogue, you put on tefillin if you're a man, or you pray without tefillin and not necessarily in a synagogue if you're a woman. Then you eat kosher food. These are fascinating things. But you're doing it because it's automatic pilot. Just automatic pilot. There's no challenge. And so therefore, what you're doing is, you're just moving along on the same pattern. You might even, you know, people always have terrible temptations which get in the newspaper and the news of the world if they give in to them. If they don't give in to them, well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. But you could have people who are cold by nature. That's how he described it. Cold by nature. They're not even tempted by anything. They just sail along on the straight and narrow without any challenge whatsoever. And he actually calls that not serving God. Now, if you're challenged, if it's difficult, if it's not so easy, if the kosher food, you know, I live with my wife, we live in Stamford Hill. It's quite hard to buy non-kosher food in Stamford Hill. Every single shop, all the food shops are kosher, even the non-Jews come into the kosher shop. And if people want, some extreme concept of kashrus, like, you know, Chol of Yisrael, you know, Jewish supervised milk, it's delivered to the door by the milkman. It's there. You're absolutely in this environment. Welcome. It's all there, laid on. There is no struggle whatsoever. However, if the person has a challenge, now the example which is given in this particular book, let's use, if I haven't lost it, the red, it's orange. Okay, the example he gives is how much Torah a person studies. It used to be the custom to study every piece of Mishnah. You see, the Mishnah, the way the ancient Talmudic system of education worked, is that first of all, people would learn the Tanakh by heart, and then they would learn the Mishnah by heart. And the way they learned the Mishnah by heart is simply by repeating it. That's why, it's one of the reasons why it's the word Mishnah, which comes from a word meaning repeating, like the word Shana, a year, which is a cycle that repeats again and again. So they would repeat the Mishnah again and again. And there's a Gemara which says, what does it mean, serving God or not serving God? If someone repeats his chapter of Mishnah, HaShomeh Pirko, 100 times, that's called not serving God. But if he repeats it 101 times, that is serving God. So now that's an amazing thing. Just by repeating the Mishnah once more, one is doing something which is suddenly called serving God. That's an amazing idea. Why? Because 100 times was the norm, and everyone did it 100 times, and so you got into the practice, you repeated the Mishnah, you learned the chapter of Mishnah, you repeated it 100 times, fine. Then comes the 101st time. You're doing something extra. This is suddenly taking you beyond the norm. And of course you're challenged. Why should you be different? Why you can't be bothered? It's late, you've got to do this and that. There are 100 different temptations in order to stop you doing it that 101st time. And the Talmud brings a mashal, brings a comparison of a taxi rank. The taxi rank was run by camel transport. Mule transport, shuk shel chamarim. So to hire a mule for 10 parsa, like 10 miles, you paid 1 zuz, and for 11 miles, it was 2 zuz. Makes sense for us in London. In London, the taxis have what's called the 6-mile limit. Within the 6-mile limit, it's on the clock. More than 6 miles, oi. You better discuss it with the driver first, because it could be anything. So the point is that the extra mile that the mule driver is taking you or your produce, that he normally for 10 miles that's normal, but an extra mile, that's something special. So in other words, serving God means doing something extra. Now there's a beautiful Gemara in Sota, page Lamed Aleph, 31a, which talks about serving God from love or from fear. And it speaks about how the person who serves God from love is greater than the one serving from fear. And it talks about it earlier on chapter on page 22b. It also spoke about the same kind of subject, but a little bit different, and Rashi explains the difference. We have the idea of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm means that this excitement, this doing of something extra, that is making one's Jewish life something interesting, something meaningful. Something that one is ready to get up early in the morning, or go to bed late at night, or go somewhere difficult, or do something difficult, or spend extra money or extra time. It's the love, it's the ahava, it's interesting the discussion here between ahava and yira, love and fear. Rashi points out this does not mean fear in the sense of fear of punishment. Fear of punishment is another issue. We can look at the way that people keep within the Jewish fold as a kind of just in case. Just in case. I'd rather look at this, an example from outside Judaism. Voltaire was the father of the Enlightenment. And he, in the 18th century in France, he poured scorn on everything to do with tradition, with the Bible. He wrote an encyclopedia. He and his friends, they wrote what they called the encyclopedia, making fun of everyone in the Bible, in Tanakh. And his ideas led to the French Revolution. And anything traditional, he mocked completely. You know what he did on his deathbed? He asked for a priest. He said he's sorry. He gives up all this terrible atheism. He's returning to God. So why? He wanted to hedge his bets. Maybe, who knows? there may be some reckoning to do, and so he wants to make... That is, if you look at that in a Jewish context, that would be considered yirat ha'onesh, fear of punishment. Now, fear of punishment is a reality when one looks at it, not as fear, but in terms of consequences. If, you know, you've been given this, you have this nice computer, and your little son or grandson is playing around with this computer, he's got a nice cup of milkshake, sweet milkshake, just next to the computer. You know, the worst thing for a computer keyboard is sweet, anything sweet. If it's not sweet, like coffee without sugar is not so bad, but with a sweet milkshake on the keyboard, that's the end of the keyboard. So you are worried. Just be careful with that milkshake next to the computer, because if you spill it, it will spoil the computer keys. You won't be able to use it. Yirat ha'onesh, fear of punishment, is really a kind of consequences. You know, if you do this, then there's that. If you do this, then there's that. And there's a kind of spiritual knock-on effect. It can sometimes be in terms of a lack of spiritual effect cosmically. You see, each one of us is actually transforming the world. The Rambam writes, Maimonides writes in the Laws of Tshuva, Hilchot Tshuva, chapter 3. He talks about the way a person should consider themselves equally balanced between good and evil, and the whole world is equally balanced between good and evil, and his or her next step is going to transform the whole world, himself and the whole world, either to good or to the opposite. So there's a cosmic effect. So when we speak about fear of punishment, it's really being aware of the tremendous effect that we can have. Here we are, we're like the little boy with a milkshake next to the keyboard, and if we spill the milkshake on the keyboard, oy vey, it's a terrible problem. But there are other dimensions. There is ahavat Hashem, there is love of God. Love. Now love is a very interesting concept. Remember, we began with the problem of brothers becoming others. In other words, the love between individuals being reduced and instrumentalized, that instead of loving each other, we're just going to see what we can get the best out of each other. And to a certain extent, that might apply in our spiritual relationship with God, with the Torah, with Jewishness and Judaism and Jewish teaching. So what we are looking at, the issue, you know, all this is trying to define what we're trying to look at together this evening. The issue is, where do we find the ahava, the love dimension within Jewish teaching, which includes, incidentally, the yira, a pure kind of fear, not fear of punishment, but a sense of awe, the love and the awe. How do we find that within our Jewish lives? There is an old mashal, there is an old metaphor for the Jewish relationship with God, which is there in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, which presents the Jew and God as husband and wife, the wife and the husband, and the relationship between them is something of the love between a husband and a wife to a husband. what happens when, in some sense, the excitement, the thrill, is somehow the years have gone by and one doesn't feel exactly that same sort of excitement? What do? We try to look a little bit deeper and to try and see ways in which we can find suggestions about the Jewish lives that we live and others are living, how to give a little bit more challenge, excitement, something new and something beautiful. Okay. Now all that is supposed to be the introduction to the little talk I want to give you. And so to go on, I want to do a little diagram, but it might be that at this point, which is a kind of a turning point, if someone has a burning question that they would like to ask, we could take a couple of questions at this point, because then we're moving, we're changing direction at this moment. Has anyone got a question? Yes.
Because there is also, I don't know where it's coming from, but that you can be chayav mita if you are going over.
Yes, excellent. Yes, yes. Okay, so that's a very beautiful point. There's a theme called Baal Tosif. You're not allowed to add. So, for example, the halakha is you should have a mezuzah on the door, but not two mezuzah. That's the example that is brought by the sages is it says there should be four compartments in the tefillin. We mustn't make five. So at the same time, so there's Baal Tosif, we mustn't add. But at the same time, it says in the in Pirkei Avot, right at the beginning, Va'asu siyag la-Torah, make a fence around the Torah. So in other words, there is the idea of doing something extra in order to protect the guarding of the Torah. Now, it might be protecting the Torah. There are two ways. Yes, I think this is a very important point, and it's very well worth talking about it at this moment. So I'm taking this from the very first Mishnah of Pirkei Avot, V'asu siyag la-Torah, make a fence around the Torah. The fence is in order to protect the Torah. Now, in which way is it to protect the Torah? Is it to protect the Torah that we don't break the Torah? That's the normal way of understanding it. Or is it to protect the Torah so the Torah becomes more exciting? You do something extra which makes the Torah more exciting. For example, I was pleased to hear at the announcements in the shul, thank you very much indeed, I was pleased to hear in the announcements in the shul, Tikkun Leil Shavuot. There's going to be a Tikkun Leil Shavuot, staying up part of the night, however long, on the first night of Shavuot, studying Torah, hearing little talks about Torah, something. That's an exciting thing to do. It's not a mitzvah from the Torah. It's a custom. In fact, it's a Kabbalistic custom. But it's a beautiful thing. It makes it more exciting. So that's the kind of extra. You know, there are certain extra things which make it more fun. It's a more exciting thing to do. And you need the right kind of guidance to know when is it making a fence around the Torah, making something inspiring, adding a little bit of ahava, adding a bit of ahava, of love into the mixture. And when is it Baal Tosif, that you are not allowed, do not add, right? Do not add an extra mitzvah, like Eve told the snake, God said we shouldn't eat from the tree nor touch it. And God had only said don't eat from it. So the snake pushed her hand onto the tree, said, ah, look, you've touched it and nothing happened. So her adding something extra caused the whole problem. But at the same time, we have the idea of making a fence around the Torah. Okay, so any other point at this junction? Right, okay. So, one second, sorry, I've already started off. You'll have a chance later on, and apart from the general discussion, there will also be the possibility of private discussion. Now, I would like, I'm thinking graphically, so I'm going to... This represents our normal, regular... Our, my, yes, you could say, each one of us can write my, our normal Jewish practice. A friend of mine was once in a London taxi cab. London taxi cabs are wonderful. There are two kinds, there's the black cab and there's the mini cab. This was a black cab. The people who drive the black cabs have to train for quite a long while. It's called the knowledge. It's very interesting. And many Jewish people, when they first came to this country in the 1910, 1920, they became cab drivers because they were then independent. They could keep Shabbat and Yom Tov and so on. So there's a certain Jewish tradition of these taxi drivers. So a friend of mine was sitting in this cab, and... you can talk to the driver. And he gets talking to him, and he says to him, are you Jewish? The driver says, yeah. So my friend says, do you ever go to shul? And the driver says, yes, I do. Goes past a few seconds. Then the driver says, mind you, I sometimes miss a year. He goes once a year on Yom Kippur, presumably. Some people, I once met someone who told me, I go once a year to shul. Do you know when that is? I said, I don't know. The AGM. but anyway, he goes once a year to shul, to presumably on Yom Kippur, but occasionally it doesn't work out. There's the cup final at that time. You know the story of what happened at the cup final. It's a terrible thing. It worked out the cup final was on Yom Kippur. And he comes to the rabbi and he says to the rabbi, what can I do? The cup final is on Yom Kippur. So the rabbi said, well, you could watch a video. So the man says, the whole service? So it's a matter of priority. But this is a person's normal Jewish practice. Now, if you were imagining this sort of, this couple, this middle-aged couple, and they're feeling, where's the zest, where's the excitement that they used to be? They might end up in a help room somewhere, or a chat room, or some self-help book, or a counselor of some kind, or a friend who's a counselor. So the person might say to them, what used to be exciting when you were younger? What did you do which was exciting? You went for walks together, you did this together, you did that together. We could think about our Jewish lives, thinking back over our lives, what were the high points in our life? A person might remember going to the West Wall in Jerusalem, first time they went here. Something special, meeting a very great rabbi at some time, one's yeshiva years in one's youth. There are points within one's life where there is beautiful memories. These are intended to be like rays coming out of this luminary. So there were points from the past where there was something exciting. Now, it would be very interesting to do this as a kind of a little group, and Zalman wasn't quite sure how many people would come, and if it would have only been five of you, we'd have done this in a slightly different way, where people would actually share memories and reminiscences and things of that kind. But you could still think about it yourself. Think about three points of excitement about Jewishness and being Jewish and Jewish experience in your life. Are you able to locate three, only three, the three points from the past? You could go back, right back to childhood, early marriage, whatever, and just points of excitement. Are people able to do that? Are people able to locate in their minds an exciting and moving Jewish experience from the past? I'm not going to ask you what it is, right? That's, are people able to locate that in their minds? Yes? Yes? Now you see, some of those things could be repeated. If we want to make our lives more as Jews, as Jewish people today, more exciting, we could possibly repeat some of those experiences, or a version of it which is appropriate for the present. I was in Israel shortly after the Six-Day War. It was incredible. You can't repeat, you know, repeat that kind of experience, because it was a particular situation. It was you know, coming to the West Wall, which had just been conquered. It was an amazing experience. But going to the West Wall today is something very special as well. And so there are certain aspects of these blue rays, as it were, which could be repeated. And then there are further rays which is just something new that one hasn't actually thought about enough, or maybe one has, but it's putting more effort into it. And so the way in which, it's a very, really what I'm saying is trite, it's very simple. It's that if we want to get something out of Judaism, we have to put something into it. Extremely simple equation. By us putting in a little bit more effort, getting up a little bit earlier maybe, going to bed a little bit later, coming to something, doing something, those are the ways that we are able to make it a living, exciting experience for oneself, as an individual, for one's family, and for one's community together, as something that we're all sharing. Let's start with a key concept. Look at this. The Torah. Torah study. We are here in a community, this beautiful Dublin community. Three times a week there are very specific sessions. The chief rabbi giving a shiur in Talmud. It's amazing. It's an amazing experience to study Talmud, to look at a page of Talmud with the idea what the Mishnah says, what the sages say, the Amoraim, what Rashi says, what Tosfot says a little bit, and the other commentators. It's incredible. It's exquisite. A certain sage wrote about the different levels of delight. The highest level of delight is the intellectual delight which comes from studying something exciting. Talmud study is exquisite. There is a Parsha study, Sedra of the Week, being studied every week with Rav Zalman. There you have it, looking at the Sedra, the Parsha of the Week, the Torah, the different commentaries, different ideas arising out of it. And the third thing, a one-to-one chavrusa setup, where people can study with another person, taking something of their choice and exploring a little bit further Jewish teaching. Now this, Torah study, has always been the Jewish recipe in the most difficult situations. There is a book called Responsive from the Holocaust. Responsive from the Holocaust is written by Rabbi Oshri, Ephraim Oshri, Zichron Lebracha. He was a Rav, a rabbi in Kovno, Slobodka, and it was the Holocaust. Kovno was made into a ghetto by the Germans, Yimach Shemom, and 30,000 Jews were herded into a small area. And there were rabbis there, and people were living, and many of them very knowledgeable Jews. And he records different aspects of the experiences that people had from the point of view of the questions that they asked the rabbis. All kinds of questions. And the kind of situation that they were in. There's a Holocaust account of a group of people who were on a work relay. They had to go out in the morning, they had to go to the forest and chop wood. And there was a young man there, a Gera Chosid, who knew quite a lot of Talmud by heart. And as they were walking along, he would sing a line of Talmud, and everyone would repeat it behind him. And so they would go through an Amud of Talmud, something like that, a half a one side of a page of Talmud, as they were going line by line with him, singing through the words and the people repeating it. They did not know whether they would be shot that day or what would happen, but they knew that at that moment they had the Torah of Hashem, this Torah from God, and it was given to them, as we're going to be saying on Shavuot, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, God says, I am Hashem, your God, Anochi, I, Anom, I, myself, Nafshi, my soul, my very being, Ketavit, I have written, Yahavit, I've given it to you. God gives and writes himself down and gives himself to us in the written Torah and in the oral Torah, in the Talmud, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Tanakh, in everything. So there is this flow coming to us in Talmud study, in Torah study. Another example of Torah study is at home. Friday night, Shabbat. Beautiful opportunity for a family together, might be just a husband and wife and children, to talk about something to do with the Sedra. It happens that my Chabad research unit produces every week a little thing which gets mailed to people or they get it on the internet, and they are able to read out a little page about the Sedra. One is sort of like for student or adult level, one is for a children's level. And it's a way that the family together have some kind of family group experience of something about the Torah. On the internet today, it's just amazing what a person is able to find. They can find shiurim, audio shiurim. I've seen some shiurim where you click on and the page of the text which you're studying is there in Hebrew and it's being explained. It's an amazing thing. And so there are many different ways that each one of us can click in to Torah study. So that's Torah. Now, I've written it in red. Maybe it should be in blue, because everyone has studied a little bit of Torah, and maybe a lot of Torah. And just to add a little bit extra zest, to study a little bit more in order to make one's Judaism, one's own Judaism meaningful, and that of one's children and grandchildren. I remember I used to, my Chabad research unit it's called, it's an outreach research unit apart from my work in the university, but somehow finding ways of making Judaism relevant to people, so in people's homes, people give shiurim in people's homes. So someone gathers a group of people in his home and then someone comes and gives a shiurim. gives a talk of some kind, or they study a text. So I was working with a particular family, and this family, he was bringing groups of people to his home, adults. Sorry that it's going so late, I will try and finish very soon. And one day I had, and he was telling me how worried he was about his son. His son was in university, and he was worried about him. And one day I phoned the father in order to make some kind of arrangement, what time I'm coming. The father is out, but the son answers the phone. Hello, how are you? Start talking together. And it turns out this son is highly involved with the Jewish society, and they're making a Shabbaton, and they're doing this and that. And it seemed the father didn't know anything about this. The son could see that his parents are hosting a whole shiur group every 2 weeks in their home. And he is actually, in his own way, he's following suit. It's having an effect on him. The communication between the parents and the children was so low, the parents did not actually know that this was happening. But because the parents were doing something, it was having an effect on their children. Now, there's Torah, there is prayer, and there are mitzvot. So those are the three areas. And then I'll finish. And the Torah I've spent more time on, and I'm going to go very quickly through prayer. Prayer is something which takes place in the synagogue, takes place in the home, and takes place in the heart. The way to make prayer more meaningful is by putting a little bit more of oneself into the prayer. That might mean spending a few minutes reading something spiritual which helps in one's approach to prayer. There is a whole genre of Jewish literature in order to help one have a more positive attitude to davening and to life. Rabbi Tversky wrote a book with like a thought for each day. There is a whole range of literature which can make prayer into something. First of all, learning the meaning of the prayers. Just taking a book, an art scroll book, has got the translation, it's got a commentary, saying something about what the prayers are. That little bit of investment, you put something in, you get something out. Mitzvot. There are the mitzvot which we are used to doing and which we are very comfortable with. Even then, there can be a little bit extra. We have mezuzot on our doors. When was the last time the mezuzot were checked? Does every door which should have a mezuzah, has it got one? Our tefillin, are we putting on tefillin? Getting ourselves, making sure that we have tefillin, that we're putting them on, that we are keeping that mitzvah. The idea of lighting Shabbos candles for women and for girls for that matter. The idea that there is a zest, there is an excitement in the mitzvot of the Torah. And there is a whole range, whether it's mikveh, this town. Mr. Steve was telling us today about the history. There was some kind of attempt at having a mikveh even in 1880 here in Dublin. It was wonderful. That's the going back to that sort of time. Then in the early 20th century, they built a proper mikveh in the synagogue in town. And there's the whole idea of bringing the sanctity of Judaism into every aspect of one's life. So my message this evening is very, very simple. We invest a little bit more into the whole process, which can be challenging. It's a change of momentum. It needs effort. And we have to climb. And to go back to that image, the person is moving along like that, and then he goes up. There is a jump. But after the jump, he's also going along at a sort of, he's jumped up to that level. There has to be another jump. And then that is our life, going higher and higher and higher. The Kabbalists call God Ein Sof, the infinite, because there's no limit how high we can reach. And so therefore, step by step, I think these are the ways to make being a Jew in the modern world, keeping Jewish life, can be something incredibly exciting in every way. Thank you.
challenged listening to such a wonderful discourse, and I think we've all gained from it. I think looking around the room, it is only the start of what could be a very long journey for each and every one of us. I'd like to invite some questions. Now, I'm sure there are many from that thought-provoking lecture.
The speaker mentioned love of God. Does that coincide with Joseph Carroll, who enunciated that the principle of prayer was to thank God for your blessings?
It does correspond with Joseph Carroll, yes. Joseph Carroll was himself a deep mystic, actually, a Kabbalist, and certainly he is talking about prayer as thanking God for what he gives us. There's praising God, there is asking God for what we need, and there is thanking God. But in order to reach that, that's in the Amida, and that's the three sections of the Amida: the beginning three blessings, the middle blessings, and the end blessings. Praising God, asking God, and thanking God. But in order to reach that, we first of all have Psukei Dezimra, Baruch Sha'amah, Ashrei, and so on. Then we have Kriyat Shema, the saying of the Shema, and then we reach the Amida. The Zohar, also emphasized by the Piasechna Rebbe, Rabbi Kalonymus Kalman Shapiro of Warsaw, called the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, they call it, there's the temple, the outer courtyard of the temple, the inner courtyard of the temple, and the bayit, the heichal, the actual temple structure. So you have the initial part of the morning prayers, then the Kriyat Shema, and then finally the Amidah as the climax, where you're going through the temple courtyard, the outer courtyard, the inner courtyard, then into the Holy of Holies, as if you were the high priest. Well, certainly, this totally accords with what Rabbi Yosef Karo is saying. Anyone else? Yes?
I wonder, first of all, thank you very much for the shiur. I wonder, could you talk to us about the problem there is nowadays of the gap that is open between those people who are reaching higher and higher and those people who are left behind, and the feeling that the people who are left behind have that they can't reach anywhere towards the others anymore, and the gap is too wide?
I think what we as parents and community have to show is a genuine sense of welcome to every single Jew. That if a Jewish person walks into the synagogue, let's say, or is doing something, and he's a boy, he's not wearing a head covering, he's not something not appropriate about the way he's dressed. A girl, perhaps, maybe other ways of not being appropriately dressed. We have to just radiate love, positive, towards that person, to see that person as a child of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rachel, Rachel, Rivka, and Leah. And there is this child, and our great ancestors are saying to us, my descendant is there in your hands. He or she has walked into your purview. They're somehow at your event. They're in your whatever it is. They've come to your thing. Be nice to them. Smile to them. Look at that person as someone precious. Make the other become a brother or a sister. So love is, I believe, one of the ways that we can help them feel that the way is not so far. Love them as they are at this minute. It's not just a question that, well, if they start coming to Shiurim, then they will change and they'll become religious, and so there'll be another nice religious family in wherever it is. Love them as they are. That is what's called an Ud Mutzal Me'esh, a firebrand which is saved from the fire. Every Jew today who is alive and who thinks of themselves B'Shem Yisrael Yechuneh, that in some way they are called a Jew, that's amazing. That taxi driver, he goes to shul once a year. On Yom Kippur. Imagine. A 3,300-year-old tradition, and he is still keeping it. He's surrounded by God knows what, and yet he's still doing it. Love the person for what they are. That is, in one line, my advice. How, and it's very difficult. It's often extremely difficult, and we have to somehow see through the coverings and see the diamond at the heart. Yes?
Say as well, I feel that the people sometimes, when they climb to that peak, do not look back kindly at all at these other people. They don't look. They've forgotten what they've forgotten.
When anyone does something which is not perfect, we have to compensate. So we have to try. If you're aware that there's a problem, and I'm aware there's a problem, so we will compensate, and we will try to provide the love, even if someone else, for whatever reason, isn't doing that.
But they're not acting as religious Jews, really and truly, in the full sense of the word anymore. This is what I'm trying to say.
You mean the ones who reject?
Yes.
We don't have to evaluate. You know, it's, they have another problem. Let's say, I mean, for example, you know, a thing that shocked the entire Jewish world in the last few months was the actions of certain members of Naturikata going to Iran to take place in a Holocaust revisionist Holocaust conference, that the Holocaust didn't really take place or didn't take place the way that the Jews say. It was horrifying. But we don't have to, as they say, bodek the tzitzit, to check the tzitzit of the gentleman who took part in them. That. It's his problem. What we do have to try to do is mitigate the fallout. And so if we find someone who is damaged by that in some way or damaged in another way, we have to try to help them. And I think there is looking at the Jewish people as a totality, we have to try and see the heart within the Jewish people, and within each Jew, the heart within that Jew, and within that heart, the Nekudat HaYadit, the Jewish point, the essence of that Jewish man or woman. And that is the reality, which is the way, I believe. It's by focusing on that. You see, there is... some colleagues of mine are very interested in quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is a very recent, relatively recent, last 25 years, form of physics, where the way you look at the thing has an effect on the way the thing is. Now, psychotherapists and educators have been talking about that for a long time. In chinuch, in educational theory, they say, if you look at the child in a positive way, then that child will respond in a positive way. And that's, I think that's what we have to be trying to do. Yes?
Yeah. You have three words on the right hand side. As far as my eyesight is concerned, I think you've written the words Karo, Prayer, and Mitzvot. I think that our whole lives are in fact involved with something far more than those three concepts. There is another force and another power which in fact operates and guides us in our continuity. I met on one occasion a woman from the Holocaust who had come from a frum home, and she left entirely everything that she knew of Yiddishkeit behind her, because she stated there could not be a Kaddish Baruch Hu in the heavens who would have allowed to have happened what she went through. And she never again involved herself with Yiddish. But she married, and she still continued her attitude. And today, she has grandchildren who, uneducated by her, in any sense of the word,
two of them are becoming Rabbanim.
Beautiful.
Now, therefore, it could not be from Torah, from prayer, and from Mishnah,
Mitzvah,
by herself, that this has to occur. It has come from somehow Min HaShemayim, from Hashgacha Pratit.
I think that's very beautiful. And you were speaking about the way in which God radiates to us from above. And the way in which God loves every single Jew in the world and is pouring this love and this sense of connection. What is written on the board is what we can do about it when we suddenly wake up a little bit more or try to wake ourselves up. When there is no argument with her, this lady, she has been through the most incredible things. I know a man who is a Holocaust, I know of him, I didn't meet him. He is a Holocaust survivor. He lives on a housing estate in America. This housing estate is very exclusive. It does not allow Jews to live in the housing estate. They have one person who vets every application of anyone who wants to come and live in the housing estate. And the reason for vetting it is to make sure that person is not Jewish. This Holocaust survivor, who is in disguise, no one there knows he's Jewish, he's the one who makes sure no Jews come into this housing estate because they may blow his cover. And his niece told me about this at a Holocaust conference in London. But there is no criticism of this man. He has his own cheshbon with God, and that will have to be sorted out in a way far beyond my level of understanding. However, his niece was there in a Holocaust event with people talking about Torah and what did the rabbis say about the Holocaust. You know, and the way in which the children of that person that you mentioned, how they make the step towards becoming Rabbanim is precisely through Torah, prayer, mitzvah. That's the step they can do. So there is always the love from God to every individual in every situation. And it could well be that the person seems completely to be lacking in these beautiful garments of Torah, prayer, mitzvah, and nonetheless, the essence is there. The nekudat hayadut, the inner point of Jewishness, which is something tremendously, tremendously profound.
I've never seen in Dublin an audience sit for so long, so quietly. I think we've all been enthralled by your discussion this evening. I think you've started something that is very important for us all. You've raised so many questions. And all I can say on our behalf is thank you so much. And please God, we'll have the opportunity to hear more and more from you in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.